Hello, everybody, and welcome to Disc Coverers, the only podcast online that reads, reviews, and ranks all 42 of Terry Pratchett's seminal series of fantasy comic novels, The Discworld. I'm your host, Iris J. Pronouns are she or z, if you're feeling spicy. Why don't my co-hosts introduce themselves, starting with, I think, let's do Grace first, and then June and Belina. I'm just doing these in no particular order.
Yeah. I am the internet's beloved Princess Grace, Fae Fair, or she, her, if you're boring, and it's delightful to be here.
You'll never guess my name. No one has ever heard it before. It certainly wasn't said by Iris 10 seconds ago. My pronouns are she, her. I'm June.
I am still Belina by sheer process of elimination. I am still she, her in most situations, but we'll figure out the rest of that later.
Hooray! And today we are here to talk about, I believe this is the 13th book in the Discworld series, and a direct sequel, first time that's really happened since The Late Fantastic, a direct sequel to a previous book, Lords and Ladies, another witches book, sequel to Witches Abroad, and mostly taking place in the witches' home territory of Lankra.
This is 14, for what it's worth.
Is it 14? Oh, shoot. Oh, man. All the disc heads are going to be after me now. This is number 14, actually.
Is that what we've decided to call them? Disc heads?
Disc heads, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, the thing about finding a disc head, as long as you like balance a flower pot or something on top, you can usually subdue them long enough to get away.
It was that or diskies.
Diskettes.
Oh. Diskettes! Oh, that's so good. Okay, well, fellow diskettes, get excited, because we're covering Lords and Ladies today. And let me tell you, it was a very interesting book.
Okay, I do just, before we get any fan mail about this, I do want to remind folks that the first two books literally have a span of about 0 seconds between them.
The first two books aren't really separate books. They're kind of...
It's the first direct sequel since The Light Fantastic.
It's the first good direct sequel.
Yeah,
okay, there
the
we
first
go.
One that
there
counts.
We go. We'll take
you know,
that
this I'd say that this book is really the first book in which Terry Pratchett really comes into his own. It's the first real Discworld.
This is a watershed. I can feel it.
It's the second book where Pratchett takes all of the things he did in a previous book with very much the same theme and just does it again, but much better this time.
Yeah. If you keep trying, sooner or later, you're bound to make it good. And this is proof of that.
If it wasn't obvious, I liked this book a lot, and I certainly liked it more than Witches Abroad.
It was definitely better than Witches Abroad. And if you're thinking about reading one without reading the other, don't worry, because you won't miss much by not reading Witches Abroad. It's still okay. I mean, see our episode on it for more information about it. But this also stands on its own, which is great. Before we get too deep into discussing the book's contents itself, do we want to turn it over to our expert synoptrix, Belina, for a rundown of what this book was about?
Woo!
All right. This is the first time that I haven't sat here and just done it 5 or 6 times just to practice ahead of time, so my apologies if I trip all over myself. But anyways, the witches have gotten back to Lankra, having spent the entire time we were reading and recording the Small Gods episode traveling back from Genoa. When they arrive, Cairn Varens informs Margaret that they are to be married soon. Margaret does want this, but doesn't really like the fact that she was never actually asked. Also, being a queen seems to be the dullest job in the world. Meanwhile, it's circle time, right around midsummer, when realities get a little too close to one another, and that means that elves are trying to get in again. While the real witches were out, some upstart kid who calls herself Diamanda Tockley was taking instructions from the elf queen to talking to her across the barrier, and she'd taken her own little coven to do their nonsense up near the dancers. One of those magnetic sort of standing stone circles built around the weak points in reality sort of thingies. The elf queen had been tempting the girl with promises of power, and when the real witches attempt to de-escalate, this results in the public showdown between Granny Weatherwax and Diamanda. The latter loses by not understanding the way these stories work and flees to the dancers to beg for more power. Granny tries to stop her, but the two of them end up in the elves' kingdom, face-to-face with the elf queen directly. Escape goes great, except for the part where Diamanda takes an elf arrow into the shoulder, leaving her unconscious and extra weak to elvish influences. On the plus side, now nobody's going to actually let the elves in. However, we're only about halfway into the book, so that's not the end of it. The Lankra Morrismen, who are to put on a production of Fantasy and Midsummer Night's Dream make the horrible mistake of rehearsing too close to the dancers, getting drunk on Scumble and spending the night dreaming there. This gives them the horrible idea to host the play itself at the dancers themselves. On the night of the wedding, circumstances caused all three of the witches to miss the entertainment, meaning that nobody was actually around who could have stopped the play from doing its thing and getting enough glamour into the audience that caused them to take apart the dancers and give the elves free run over Lanker. Granny Witherwax, who had been distracted by premonitions that weren't hers and quite convinced that she was going to die soon, is whisked away by Arch-Chancellor Ridcully in an attempt to rekindle an old romance, then gets kidnapped by elves, keeping her from solving everything on her own again. Nanny Ogg, along with returning dwarf Casanunda, head to an alternate entrance to the Elvish Kingdom to ask the Elf King himself to put a stop to this nonsense. He says he'll consider it. Margaret, having been pushed entirely too far past her own limits by being jerked around and kept out of loop for the entire book, finally gets tired of being nice and goes apeshit. Finding the armor of the former Queen Yinsi, a legendary founder of Lanker who, it turns out, didn't actually exist, she gets the idea in her head that being a warrior queen is what the kingdom needs right this moment, and proceeds to rack up a higher body count than any other human in the book. When she finally reaches the dancers, so do all of the remaining free people of Lanker, and between their roused rebels and Granny's endless prodding and apparent self-sacrifice, Margaret breaks free of the Elf Queen's glamours and would absolutely have killed her if the Elf King himself hadn't shown up at that precise moment, put a stop to this nonsense, and pulled everyone back across into their own universe. As is tradition in any royal wedding in popular media, the actual wedding itself takes place in a little bit later after everyone has calmed down in the aftermath of disasters as people tie up the loose ends. Margaret and Varence are proclaimed warrior, queen, and fool, and everyone starts to tie up all the rest of the loose ends. Oh, and Granny's okay. She's fine. She was just busy being bees for a while.
Woo! Wow, well done.
Yeah. Yay, that was really good. You could have fooled me by not telling us that... That was your first time actually reading it out loud. That sounded great.
I'm not going to sit here and be self-deprecating about it. Thank you.
You did a great job summarizing the book and including enough jokes that it was like, oh yeah, no, this is definitely a summary of a Discworld book. That was, yeah, that's most of it. It's weird. When we summarized Small Gods, there was I felt like it was like, wow, I feel like we've missed most of the book. But here you kind of got most of it. I don't feel like there was a ton that got left out there.
I mean, almost, I said this before we recorded, but like almost everything happens in the last third of the book.
Yeah. Like most of the book is like, oh, these are why elves are bad. And then eventually the elves show up and they're bad for the reasons we already know.
Yeah. This book is mostly vibes, but that's not a bad thing.
I actually found it kind of tense a lot of the time in the way that I haven't found most of Pratchett's books. Like a lot of the older books when there's just kind of, yeah, there's a threat. It's coming. It's dangerous. It didn't really feel like it. It felt like it wasn't, I shouldn't care, or like, someone should do something. Why is no one doing something? Why are you all sitting around and doing something else? This book really kind of threaded the needle between those of, okay, this is obviously dangerous, but also I get why everyone's being weird assholes instead of doing anything about it.
Why nobody is telling Margaret anything about what's going to happen.
Again, I guess I did completely skip over this in the summary, but the elves in this one, I don't know any other depiction that's really anywhere close to how Pratchett describes them. They're just horrible, bloodthirsty creatures. He kind of describes them as cats, but they're smart enough to actually have malice in their hearts.
Yeah, they're like primeval, like tricksters, but in like a bad form.
The kind of
that.
Trick
it's
where
really
it's not so much slipping on a banana peel as having an anvil dropped on your head.
Yeah,
yeah, it's something that I think you see a lot nowadays, I wonder, like, it was probably very common, but it's definitely one of the more, like, I didn't expect to see it here, is I guess what I'd say. And it's done really well, and it's really cool.
Mm-hmm. And it's really horny.
Yeah, like you see a lot more fantasy. We're getting it out of the way. You see a lot more fantasy media nowadays that is kind of negative towards elves because it's like, oh, they're so stuck up. Oh, they think they're so perfect. Blah 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 blah. To the point where that kind of it itself has become kind of a deconstructivist fantasy cliche. But still, you really don't see anything where they're just like this. Sort of upsetting, like a force of nature, basically, like they are in this book. Like, they really are on a similar level, and we'll get to that when we get to the book Carpe Jugulum, though in a completely different way. But they really are kind of occupying a similar space as vampires sometimes occupy, where they're just so, they just don't give a shit about empathy at all. They're just regard our entire universe as just kind of a playground now, that they can fuck with. which is like
I guess
wild.
That I mean obviously they're borrowing really heavily from, you know, the fae folk, you know, the actual older legends where the fae folk will just fuck your shit up.
But
usually they're at least somewhat tricky about it. The most complicated joke any of the elves tell in this book is, isn't it hilarious that I just killed you?
Yeah, there's a sense of, like, you can make a deal with them, but you shouldn't because of these reasons. The elves in this book are just like, you shouldn't talk to them, because if you talk to them, you die.
Yeah, like...
instantly.
Magritte manages to extract a promise out of one of them that they won't hurt her, and then they're just like, ha, I lied, fuck you. You know, it's... yeah, there's... it's less wordplay than you usually get with fae. It's more just, you know, these creatures of terrible beauty, these ageless beings with their weird red and orange and blue morality, that's the word. And they're like, you know, humans are fun, but not really like anything worthwhile.
It's also something that Pratchett doesn't do a ton most of the time. Like, especially later on, he really, as time goes on, he starts really, really avoiding the whole, these are just bad guys because they're bad guys and they just aren't human in any way. His favorite thing is to make the villains very human. So it's interesting to see it done here. And it's also interesting to see it done in a way that's genuinely scary.
Yeah, this was a horror book. Like,
we even get
some ways.
I think it's Redkeller or Ponder saying, like, explicitly, this isn't like the Dungeon Dimensions. This is more interesting than that.
Yeah, the Dungeon Dimensions, you know what they're going to do. The elves will find new ways to surprise and horrify you.
Yeah. The Dungeon Dimensions are out there. The Elfland is over there. It's different.
Yeah.
I love the conceit in general of... I think this is the first book that I really ran into the concept, but I love the conceit of parasite universes. Not parallel ones, parasite ones. And that they are universes that aren't necessarily entirely fleshed out fully and need to depend on the, like, the belief and the stories of an existing universe they can remora onto. It kind of actually, in a weird way, is a nifty little bookend with Small Gods, and that book is very concerned about, like, deriving power from telling stories and gaining belief. And this book is too, but it's more like wild belief that isn't really used for worship. It's more just like forcing obeisance onto humans.
Yeah, I think Small Gods is kind of about like the dangers of human belief in a, this is what human belief can be in a very bad way when you have someone at the top who's very evil or just the structure of organized religion. Well, this is more like human belief is actually pretty cool. It's just, wow, there's some stuff out there. Hoo boy.
Yeah, it kind of turns the thing inside out. It's interesting.
It's also just a really good book. Yeah. I like this one a lot. I really loved it.
Yeah.
What did y'all think in general?
It was sick. I had a lot of fun. I think that, like, being a fan of witches books, like, I've been enjoying every witch book we've read up until now, but, like, not to do, like, this is the first Discworld book ever, but, like, this was the first witches book where I was like, oh, right. This is what I like about witches books.
Magritte gets to, like, do things in this.
Yeah, she got to become a character.
Yeah, like, she got to kick ass. Like, she arguably set off a good chunk of the plot.
Pretty sure that the only person who killed more elves than Magritte was the librarian.
It was great.
Yeah, that was great. And, like, even before that, we got so much internality with her that kind of talked a lot towards who she was and what she wanted out of her life, which was so much more interesting than the kind of the one-note character that she played in Witches Abroad, or even how she started in Weird Sisters.
There was a moment early on where they did the no one's telling Magritte anything and Granny's being a weird dick, and, like, I was just like, oh, wow, I've read this in two books already. I'm so excited. But then they actually, like, they actually did things with it. They went into Magritte's character and who she was. And then they were like, yeah, no, Granny is just doing this because she's a weird, insecure dick. It's not a good thing. It's not, like, we're not saying that Granny's actually a genius. She just sucks here.
Yeah.
And that was great.
That was the other fun thing about this book, is that Granny, who in Witches Abroad was definitely Pratchett's favorite character to write, she's still cool in this book, but she is absolutely fallible, and, like, she even questions herself at times.
She eats, like, shit over and over
again. Has a lot of the book is about her coming to terms with getting older and figuring out, like, maybe she's not always right 100% of the time and learning to be confident in herself despite that. This really feels like a peek behind the curtain for all of the characters. Nanny Ogg, too. I mean, she isn't really hiding much behind the curtain because she's really an open book, but she gets some really good moments in this book, too. She's amazing.
She's so great here. I loved her in this book. She really gets kind of... I feel like this book is kind of her time to shine, even though that it's like... It's very much Granny and Margaret that are the focus. All of her stuff is just so great. She has so many moments when the other two of them fall apart in these ways, and she just kind of picks up the slack a little. And it's just like, that's what she does, and you can see her doing it so well.
Yeah, there's a reason that, like, in the traditional framework of the three witch coven thing, like, she's the one who gets labeled as the mother, and that's because she's, like, the manager. She's, like, good at kind of sorting things out when the Margaret and Esme are completely at odds with each other or falling to pieces from their own problems and shit. And you really see that in this book. It's really cool.
I really loved it. I really loved the looks into the characters. And I mean, I know we already mentioned this, but I really loved looking internally at Granny and seeing a lot of her... I was talking with my partner about how just, like, I'm very used to Pratchett protagonists being kind of... They struggle, but in the end, they do the right thing, and they've learned something, and you see how they've grown in this specific way. Granny sucks at the beginning, and she sucks at the end. Like, she doesn't really learn anything this book. The main thing, like, she does, I could argue, but, like, mostly she's just still kind of a weird asshole at the end. Instead, you just get to look into the things that, like, drive her, the things she struggles with. And it's really interesting and really good, honestly. Yeah, I really, like, enjoyed it.
We get two moments where Nanny gets, like, this really good, like, that Esme Weatherwax, she's always open to new ideas and so humble, too. Like, just to her face, just to give her the business. It's so good.
And Granny's just goes along with it.
Yeah, like, she knows she deserves this on some level.
More importantly, she knows that she can't stop Nanny Ogg no matter what she does.
Just an absolute avalanche of a person. Fantastic. Yeah. I thought there was, like, a lot of really interesting dialogue, too, between Granny and Nanny, and also the new witches who, well, quote-unquote witches, who are trying to start their own coven led by Diamanda. What did you think of them? What did you think of that whole sort of conflict?
I kind of wish that they'd had more time to do anything with them. Like, Diamanda basically falls out of the plot.
Yeah, she's unconscious or possessed for most of the book.
It's an interesting idea, but she does kind of just disappear.
Yeah, but because they're mostly used to, like, A, set up the bag of sweets thing, and B, to draw a parallel between, you know, some of our older witches who, like, oh, I wasn't like those young upstarts. I was always respectful of authority when I was younger. And that's really their narrative purpose, and once they've served it, well...
I want to point out that Margaret would have fucking loved them if she hadn't been kept out of the loop for them.
Yeah.
Oh my god, Margaret would have been over the moon about them.
The whole keeping Margaret out of the loop thing is interesting. It really
belies how, like, little trust that Granny specifically puts in Margaret, and always has. Like, it really makes the wet hen stuff in the last witch's book kind of feel shittier.
I really don't like the notion that Granny puts forth that, yeah, no, Granny's been an asshole to you this entire time because she was basically just toughening you up. You wouldn't have been able to do what you did if you hadn't been so fucking angry at Granny Weatherwax all these years. I really kind of hate that.
It's... Yeah. Like, because we even get, like, when they're flying up to the Long Man, which, mind you, is just it's a dick and balls they built on a hillside, like... It's like, oh, Margaret's too young to know what... Yeah, Margaret's too young to go up here. She's too young to know what a dick looks like. She's an adult, right? She's like,
okay, there was a good moment where Maggot was playing dumb to Nanny, trying to insinuate, look, you're gonna fuck the king after you get married, and then Maggot just does not have any of it, and then like 2 pages later, she's talking about how much trouble she had keeping a straight face.
Yeah,
God,
that whole plot line with that whole running gag with the, the king sends away for a book of martial arts, but it's a book about martial arts, and at the very end, he runs into Casnunda and he looks at the card, which is banned out of the whole book. He's like, "Can I talk to you in a few minutes?"
It was a great running gag, and the martial arts book coming back because was it Sean? Was that the name?
Yeah, Sean Ogg.
Yes, Sean Ogg read it and is now like, "I'm going to use martial arts on the elves." It's a great bit. There's a lot of really great running gags in this one. It's really good, honestly.
Yeah, like
this is definitely like Terry in maximum foreshadowing mode. Like, so much of the book is just foreshadowing, both in terms of plot and also in terms of jokes. But that is fine. It feels like there's a lot of connected threads throughout the book.
The absolute worst joke in the entire book, in my opinion, was a big foreshadowing thing. When they spend the entire book talking about how the Morris men are going to do the stick and bucket dance and how they can't do it, and going over it and over it and over it. And then at the very end of the book, Nanny Ogg is like, "Well, they can't do that dance in front of the ladies. Otherwise, it's sexual Morrisment."
Yeah.
And it was, I literally stood up in anger at the fact that he kept a major plot thread about, like, one of the main things that happens, because they do the entertainment and they make jokes about not being able to do the stick and bucket dance, and the whole thing is just a lead up to that joke.
Yeah. Like, we even get it with, like, so the King of the Elves is like this big, like, you know, deer man, right? He's like a big satyr guy.
Yep.
And there's some historical context to this, but I think a large part of it is so that the king spends a good like half chunk of the book possessed, or like in the elf queen's thrall or whatever, and in the morning when he's sleeping it off and starting to come back to his senses, they can say, well, it's only natural after a stag night.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest. You two just named my first two picks for best joke of the fucking books.
those were maybe the best. They were definitely the worst.
Yeah.
I loved them. I also, on the subject of the other witches, I had the thing where I don't remember exactly why, but I'm reading through it and it's like, "Oh, Agnes Nitt. I know her. Yes. How do I know her? She's going to come back later.
She comes back.
I don't know how, but I know her."
She comes back. She's great.
I adored the fact that, Agnes is the only one of the coven that goes, this seems kind of weird. I'm not really sure any of this has anything to do with witchcraft. And when the witches are giving the coven this, just taking them apart, they can say, "No, hold on. Agnes, you've got sense. We'll talk later. But the rest of you..."
Yeah. "We'll keep your resume on file. The rest of you can move along, okay?"
It felt like Pratchett might have been trying to set up like a, "Now that I'm getting rid of Maggret, I'm gonna replace Maggret with someone else in the next witch's book." I don't know if he's actually getting rid of Maggret, but like it felt like he was maybe setting that up, but then it just, nothing happened with Diamunda. See, like,
if you want like a tiniest bit of spoiler, he does replace Maggret as in the witch's triumvirate, but Maggret doesn't go away.
Yeah, that's what I thought happened.
She's still around.
Yeah, but like it seemed like he wanted to set that up and that it just didn't happen because none of them showed up because he was too busy telling a different story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but still, I thought it was really interesting that there's kind of a overall changing of the guard within the concept of witchcraft, and that like, as opposed to a very stodgy academic form of magic like wizardry, because witchcraft is passed on like orally and through like apprenticeship traditions, it's so much more sensitive to kind of the winds of change like that, and to opposing ideas and stuff. It's really kind of a conversation with the world around it, which isn't... It is a cool segue to go into. Hey, I forgot that there were wizards in this book.
I skimmed over them because they don't really do much. But like that's sort of the thing is like throughout this entire series, as much as I love them, the wizards don't really do much.
The wizards are here to like get Cassananda to Verence and to, mm-hmm. and they do have their, you know, they are the ones who give us the but first we have to talk about parasitic universes conversation.
Yeah, they're like they're the wow wow sauce of the book. They just auto condiment a little bit of extra flavor into
it. I kind of loved them. I got to admit, aside from like there were three good ones and one shitty one. Like, I loved Rid Cully. He was great. This is what I love seeing Rid Cully do, being like, I'm a wizard, but also I'm a weird, like, extremely over-the-top British guy. I'm Saxton Hale, but British. Like, great stuff. I loved getting to see Ponder Stibbins, because that was my other moment of, oh, hey, he shows up here. I know that guy.
I mean, Ponder's been showing up, and this is the first time that we really get a whole lot of him.
Yeah, and it was great, and the librarian is always welcome, and the other guy was there.
The bursar has exactly one joke.
He's just out of his mind on toad pills the whole time.
Yeah, get ready for that to continue to be his one joke.
Wow.
I mean, it was kind of funny mentioning using him as a crowbar because he'd just gone into the rigid phase of his frog pill stupor. But that's, he didn't actually do anything at any point.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it wasn't great. But at the same time, I loved Rid Cully here. It was really great to see him in this specific frame. Like, the recurring gag he makes about how, like, he gets the idea that there's alternate universes with him in them, and in some of those universes, he might have gotten married to Granny Weatherwax, and his only response to this is to keep getting mad that none of those motherfuckers invited him to their wedding.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they do that? He would have invited them to a wedding.
Yeah.
Asshole. Like, that's great. That's such a good bit.
Like, us winning tonight is a 1 in a million shot, which means that if I succeed, 999,999 of those guys will die. And those bastards didn't invite me to their wedding, so fuck them. Let's go.
Yeah, it's great. That's such a good payoff.
He's perfect at just misunderstanding things just well enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was my favorite joke of the book, for the record. The the payoff of 999,000 will get killed. They didn't invite me anyways, so far. Like, that was my favorite gag. But yeah, I really loved them in this book, and I loved Cassananda, too.
Yeah.
Cassananda was great in this. He kind of runs out of stuff to do after a while, but again, it's just nice having him around.
It was actually nice to see him just completely fail to figure out what to do and just be happy to go along for the ride because he just has no idea how to deal with a creature like Nanny Ogg.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She is a rare specimen that he's never experienced before, and he's just, like, dreamily watching her while she eats whatever you put in front of her.
He did get to make a hi-ho joke. That joke is still lingering from moving pictures, amazingly.
Like, there's a couple jokes that come back, like, we talk about whenever someone has eyes like gimlets, I have to mention, the dwarf that runs the delicatessen down on whatever street.
Yeah.
Obligations, I guess. I understand them, but I'm not going to laugh at them.
Got to keep the spirit alive, I guess. Also, speaking of Cassananda, did we want to talk about how horny this book was?
Oh, do you think absolutely.
This was, we were talking about this a little bit before we started recording. Do you think this book was more horny or less horny than the last Witch's book?
I think there's we have to define terms here, because Witches Abroad was certainly, like, characters had more sex in it. It was hornier in the sense that, like, sex is happening. This one is hornier both in that, like, the elves are horny and in that, like, there's a lot more, like, dick jokes. There's a dude named Bestiality running around. Stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, Bestiality Carter.
Yeah, who, mind you, is very kind to animals.
Okay, that was a good gag of, like, all of his sisters are named after virtues, so they figured they had to name their sons after vices.
Yeah.
The entire fucking,
Thatcher the Weaver and Weaver the Carter Carter.
Carter the Baker, Weaver the Thatcher, incredible. Carpenter the Taylor, Baker the Weaver, Taylor the other Weaver. Carpenter the and so on.
This is I think this started as like a riff on characters in Midsummer Night's Dream, but God fucking just really good that they had to keep clarifying that throughout the entire book.
This book was genuinely really funny.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I also feel like I don't know how to say this. I feel like this is the book where Pratchett really hit his stride of writing things that I see get quoted in places online as cool Pratchett bits.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to say it, but like, there was the whole elves thing, which I've seen a million times all over the place. And like, also it just felt like there were a lot of little bits that were like, oh yeah, that's a good little bit. He did a good little piece of writing there. Mm-hmm. The whole scene at the beginning with a shotting Death's horse, great stuff. That was a great little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I loved all that stuff.
I guess to run back slightly, since we already said this off the podcast, but we've got to say it once for posterity, Witches Abroad was definitely much more intentionally horny. It was definitely using sex as a theme much more. The fact that we as a group find Lords and Ladies to be quite so horny is in no small part because we are a bunch of monster fuckers.
Yes. Like,
okay, yeah, I'm sorry for interrupting your horny discussion. Yes, there was a lot of the elves are really scary and some of you like being scared.
We've got one fey gendered person in this call right this
Hello,
second.
How are you doing?
Yeah. If we can't talk about that, who can, you know?
The official Discworld sex podcast that will someday be launched. Grace will
tight
do
discs.
Tight cod pieces. The Discworld podcast that accentuates all the subtleties.
Octarine pants.
But
we would call it the wizard staff. Sorry, go ahead, June.
Oh yeah.
As opposed to the After Dark version, disc uncoverers.
Save it for the bonus episodes.
I mean, we could do a bonus episode about like sex in Discworld. We could do that.
That would be really interesting. I don't know if we could do that like immediately.
No,
I kind of want to wait
a
few books.
It would be retrospective.
Yeah. Like maybe like a couple, like maybe another year down the line. Once we're in like kind of later high Pratchett period,
when we can,
that would
when
be the
we
time.
Can start actually thinking about things as in like the arc of the series.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, please write us in which book you think is the best book to finally go, okay, we can do an episode about sex in Discworld that's R-rated and no one can listen to. Let us know where you think that line should be, like, not until after you've read Making Money, because it sure has a scene that I don't remember, because I don't remember much of that book.
Finally, an R-rated episode of Discoverers, unlike the rest of them, which were extremely clean and safe for the whole family to listen to. Yeah, no, I want the Elf Queen to kill me, basically. She seems cool. She can make you think like that you're a fucking insect, and that sounds like an excellent Friday night, IMO.
I'm not gonna lie. I was taking notes during that section.
Yeah, no, same. It's I just think it would be good to be a creature of great and terrible beauty to bring mortals under my horny thrall and so on.
Well, no, the Elf King was the guy who had horny thralls.
Well, they're antlers.
I mean, his whole shit was hot, too.
I thought the thralls were the
I'm
smaller
bisexual.
Mounds on the sides of the long man.
Those are.
I could get into both flavors.
Oh
both flavors.
God. Both genders.
Terrible beauty.
Both.
Meanwhile, I read the whole book going, wow, my co-hosts sure are perverts. This is sure going to be an episode, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
You'll never get me to admit what I read and went, oh. Anyways.
Well, what was the thing that you read and went, oh, about?
You'll never get me to admit it.
Well, I don't know. I figured asking nicely was worth a shot. Anyways, I thought also it was interesting that while we're speaking about elves, I think also a really interesting conceit of this book is that, like, kind of along the same lines as, like, this book talks about elves differently than a lot of other things talk about elves. Terry goes into why they don't like iron that much. It's not the iron itself. It's, like, the magnetic fields that they give off that fuck with the, like, the overall ambient magnetic field of the disc, or, like, the overall magic field, which is really interesting.
They're wildly attuned to magnetic fields, and they are so reliant on them that they're just terrified and disoriented. Like, if your inner ear exploded. And that's why it's so dangerous to them. It's practically a footnote in a series famous for a lot of footnotes. It's just not a footnote at all, but it just comes up very briefly and you just kind of go, oh.
I thought that was such a brilliant element because it also makes them feel more like almost animalistic. Yeah. It really reminded me of how like snakes and sharks and stuff have a sixth sense for sensing electrical fields themselves. So it was like, it was less about like, it's a magical wand, and more like, they can like kind of sense different shit, and this is horrible to them.
Well, it's an eighth sense to them, though, because this is the disc.
Oh, true, of course. There's probably fashion and smell, too, the sequel to Smell.
Blorch.
It was really great, and also it tied back in with the whole themes of what the elves are, of being, like, driven purely by that. The way it's written in the book isn't even, like, scientifically, here's why the elves are done by iron. Very, like, thematic, this is why it's horrifying.
The love of
way.
Iron.
And, like, it's great. It works perfectly in tone with the book.
Yeah, and it kind of is interesting, too, because it kind of anchors iron as, like, this very mundane material. A lot of the framing of the book is also around Jason Ogg, the blacksmith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who does a lot of iron work. And, like, it's kind of like the stable man-made-ness of iron versus the sort of like wild story energy of the elves.
Which is historically why you iron against the fair folk. It's something that represents a lot of like focused human effort and energy. Like if you have a cast iron
it's
pan,
progress.
It is something, you know, if you have a cast iron pan or whatever, it is something that took a lot of like concerted human effort to dig the ore, refine it, and hammer it into this shape.
Mm-hmm.
It was good. So I guess on a different subject, what did y'all not like in this book? Like, it's definitely not perfect. What were the things you think didn't quite work?
Pratchett keeps doing this thing where he thinks it's really funny to have, like, people doing martial arts and refer to it with, like, kind of fakey Asian names. He doesn't do it much.
Yeah.
But we do get some of that with our guard boy, with Sean.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a Pratchett book without just the slightest little frisson of fantasy racism.
Mm. Yeah, it was... There wasn't much. It was mostly avoidable, but...
At least, like, Sean was at least using English words for almost all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot less bad than Small Gods, which we just previously read. Mm-hmm. So
yes,
Small Gods is the top of the list, and that book did have more fantasy racism than this one did.
Yeah.
To be clear, I guess I don't know if I really had a ton that I didn't like. I do wish Diamanda and company could have been more involved in the plot.
Mm. Oh God!
What?
I'm just realizing her name. It's Amanda with a die in front of it. I'm just picking up on, you know, it's a cute, stupid touch, that's all.
Pratchett loves those. I felt like the whole younger witches thing didn't quite work. And also, I really agree with Belinda. There's a weird thing where, on the one hand, I kind of really like it. The fact that there's this, like, how much of this did Granny intend to do? And she was, like, purposefully planning everything to work out in the way that she wanted, but also the implication that everything was secretly exactly how she wanted it, that shows up a bit, is like,
now
it doesn't really work.
Yeah, Granny does kind of like get exactly what she wants with no consequences.
Yeah.
Sort of.
She did.
I mean,
she did think she would die.
She did almost. Yeah, that was something. But also, like,
I think it's an easy read on the book. I don't necessarily agree with it, mostly because of something at the end. Because at the very end of the book, she's having the conversation with Ridcully, where she's just kind of like, okay, fine, yeah, there's other varnished versions of me, other alternate universes, and they're happy. They're doing fine. Actually, like, I'm not the only possible way to do it, and I'm not going to admit that, because I refuse to admit that there could be any other way of doing it than mine. Fine. Shut up. Stop talking to me. And it's very revealing of how much of her, like, oh, yes, actually, I planned all of this, and I purposefully forced Magrat to be like that, and everything worked out exactly like I wanted, is kind of just her being like, I need this to not feel like the world is crumbling and that I fucked up.
It's almost like being a witch involves sharpening your confidence to a razor's edge, but over time you kind of come to rely on that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to take off the hat, I guess, sometimes. Mm-hmm. And introspect.
Yeah. Which we get a lot of. We get a lot of, like, you know, getting lost in the woods because, well, of course she knows where she is. She's right here. But as soon as that starts to fray with, you know, blah blah parallel universe stuff, blah blah getting old, etc.
I thought the bits about, not that this was like a bad part of the book, but I thought the bits about like getting older and this like fear of that, this fear of like losing the glamour of youth, that was kind of also a main theme of the book, was really like, it really had a bit of the old, like, oh man, somberness to it, I guess.
Yeah. With our beekeeper guy who just shows up to explain what the book is about to us with the old queen and the new queen.
Yeah.
I do love the joke of Magritte being like, so how do you milk them though? That was a good bit. Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting that Pratchett is thinking about that kind of thing this early on, considering how much he would become a big assisted suicide proponent later on in his public-facing career. Mm-hmm. That's how he eventually went out. And it's interesting to kind of see him starting to think about not just death in terms of death, but also like the arc of time over the course of your life. And like, kind of, is the older you get, maybe, I guess, the more you kind of have to bundle up everything that you feel makes you you and kind of force it out into the world a little bit more, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't know. This book was kind of a lot about that.
It's interesting. I think you really get a lot of that with Granny in this book, just because of how much of the book is, it doesn't really justify a lot of her shit. She just kind of does a lot of weird, awful stuff and it works out in the end. But it's not really clear that it worked out because that was the only possible way it could have worked out. It's more, it worked out because everything came together to help it work out. Because Nanny was there, because Magritte was there, because all of it.
Yeah, like, the book probably would have, the events probably would have got a lot smoother if people had, I don't know, told Magritte what was going on. But, you know.
Yeah.
They were kind of right that Magritte absolutely did not get the shit about the elves until she saw them being elves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but at the same time, specifically Magritte went, well, wait a minute, no, elves are like this. And the guy's like, well, Granny didn't tell, and Magritte's immediately like, they didn't tell me that, did they? Those motherfuckers. I'm wrong, because they were specifically avoiding telling me this. I know how that shit works, god damn it. And it was a great bit of just Magritte being like, god damn it, I'm wrong, and they were keeping it from me, and I know exactly how I'm wrong, because I know how they were keeping it from me, those fucks.
They thought I was the delicate little flower who couldn't handle the real information about witchcraft, and now look where we are. The kingdom is fucked. Fantastic. That was so great.
It was so good.
I did like the, you know, going back to what I was saying about, you know, the way witchcraft grows is, Magritte gets to be, like, the doctor. Like, it's made very clear that, like, if someone is actually injured, you go to Magritte. We get this really good line about, like, you know, Granny was a good witch because she knew that whatever kind of herb you took didn't really matter, but Magritte was a better doctor because she thought it did, or whatever.
Yeah. That was
good. Because she actually knew stuff.
I wish they had done more with that, honestly. It was a great bit of like, oh, this is why Magritte's good at things. This is what she's good at. It was good.
Yeah.
Turns out when you don't factor headology into witchcraft, you actually learn a hell of a lot in other fields.
Yeah. Magritte gets this weird thing where she is both into like this sort of like, I don't know, hippy-dippy occult bullshit. Like, she's the one with the Ouija boards and the, you know, the magic crystals and such. But she's also, like, takes after a more scientifically minded witch who, like, I don't know, knows which herbs actually do things.
Mm-hmm. She takes notes. That's important.
Yeah.
Yeah. The uniting thread there is that she doesn't just automatically assume there's only one way to do everything. Mm-hmm. So that's why she's more open to trying a wide variety of different magical stuff. She's into experimentation. And, like, also, that also probably grew out of feelings of, you know, insecurity back in Weird Sisters, where it's like, am I magical enough? Am I good enough to do this? And it's like, well, if I'm going to do this, I might as well find the most efficient and most effective way to do these things. And that's kind of what shaped her as a person. She gets to have a lot more of a character other than just the mousy one in this book, and I'm really relieved by that.
That's great. Although talking about that reminded me of something I didn't like as much. You know who doesn't get to have much of a character in this book?
Is it Varence?
Yeah, Varence is...
Yeah. Yeah, he's just some guy. He sucks.
He spent most of the... Like, he's reading, and he gets some good jokes about, like, you know, they're doing husbandry wrong, but, you know, we gotta learn how to do wifery, or, you know, they were just having sex any old way before I showed up.
It's so strange, because, like, when he shows up in... Weird Sisters, Pratchett makes a really good case for him and Margaret having this, like, it's like nerd love. It's like intense geekish chemistry, and like that just doesn't exist here. He's just like, he's too busy being king to really do, and like I get that that's the point, but they could have given him a little bit of, like, chemistry with Margaret.
Yeah.
You know?
There's none, and it's really... What?
He also spends, like, a good chunk of the book, again, like, bamboozled by the Elf Queen, because she's going to marry him to become Queen of Lanker.
Actually, on that note, what did y'all think of the entertainment?
Man, I wish I'd read Midsummer's Night's Dream at some point. I would have gotten a lot more of the joke.
Same!
I can't actually stand Shakespeare. At least I can't...
Oh no, am I the only Shakespeare fan on the podcast?
No, I like Shakespeare. I like Shakespeare. I just haven't read Midsummer's Night's Dream specifically.
Oh god, it's his breakout rom-com hit. It's one of his most popular ones. It's so good. There's so much weird shit in it.
I need to.
Yeah,
This was... They covered a... They did a whole issue about it in Neil Epic Divorce Man Gaiman's comic book Sandman. And then that book won a Hugo. And that... There was so much outcry about that issue winning a Hugo that now comics are banned from getting Story of the Year awards at the Hugos. They have to have their own separate little category.
Damn.
That was like, it was like the Beauty and the Beast of the sci-fi fantasy world.
Amazing.
Like, that fucked with people that it got nominated and
won.
So
would you say that that category got divorced from, where was it, the
Hugos? Yes, I would. Terrible Goodreads rating. Of course, we'll discuss more about that if I ever end up doing my Sandman read-through podcast, Sand Job. We'll see about that.
That's still a great name. I really like that they never showed it to us. That they just kind of like talk about it and talk about what happened and they beat around it a lot, but they never actually go like, oh, and here's where the elves invaded. Like, it's just. Mm-hmm. Oh no, a bad thing happened, and we could talk about what happened and how it happened, but you don't get to see the play itself, which is a...
I think that was an improvement on how they did it in Weird Sisters.
Oh god, yeah,
especially
definitely.
Because the witches weren't there for this one. It was just like, oh yeah, they did a play and some magic shit happened, as you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But them fighting back by doing, like, the Morris dance was really... I'd say that's, like, this book's most British joke, but also it was really good.
Yeah, like,
good.
It was great.
Them finding out that elves are weak to magic, in a sense, and using that against them was really good.
Weak to music.
What did I say?
Magic.
Magic.
Oh, damn it, yeah.
But they love music. They can't stop listening to it.
They were basically just a bunch of dancing bug zappers at that point, since it was both attracting the elves and making them stand still long enough to get clonked.
Yeah.
It was a good bit. Honestly, I loved a lot of the back half of this book. It was really fun and good. It did the thing that other Pratchett books have tried to do, which is big lead up to the horrible event and then a section inside the horrible event where they're trying to fix it. Like, he's done that over and over and over again, but it worked here.
I sort of called it out in the summary that in a Pratchett book, typically speaking, the actual threat shows up right around somewhere between 45 and 60% of the way through. Mm-hmm. It's just almost like clockwork. It's always right there, right around the halfway point. And once once it actually happens, stuff has to just go really fast until we get to the end of it.
I really liked it in those scenes. I liked seeing the inside, like seeing the horror in those areas where it was like things are bad, but they can definitely get worse. I remember him doing that in a, oh, well, like it happens in Sorcery. It happens in, what's some of the other ones? It happens in a Mort, arguably. Mm-hmm. He's done it a few times, mm-hmm. but here it didn't suck.
Yeah.
It was good.
Yeah. I will say that the extended inside of the problem scenes, combined with the fact that, like, for a very unusual twist in a Discworld book, we have an enemy that is very difficult to relate to. And the fact that it's kind of a horror book, it really kind of makes those scenes almost feel like a Resident Evil or something,
yeah.
where it's like, oh shit, we gotta be careful. There's like elves on the loose and we have to like defend our shit. Don't even bother questioning them. Just like on sight with
yeah.
these things.
It was this great.
Like that was so like, oh, I didn't expect this. I
shoots one in the eye with a crossbow bolt through the keyhole.
That
stone
rocked.
Cold.
That was great.
Like, you almost get him getting to do like the parody comedy version of that sort of thing, where as before it didn't really work because it's just bad jokes. Here it works because it's a real threat, and you're like, oh fuck. But then he still gets to have Magritte do funny stuff in ways to kill them, and it's like, oh, this is great.
Yeah,
fuck yeah,
yeah. Like he gets to have her like aim her crossbow, say, "Go ahead, bake my quiche."
That was a terrible joke.
Yeah.
That was so bad.
That joke really just doesn't even scan quite right. I know what he's going for, but it just doesn't scan.
Yeah.
It was good, though. Oh, I loved her in this book. I loved Magritte so much.
No, I
she's fantastic in this.
I mean, okay, yes, I was taking notes on the Elf Queen, but that's for important professional stuff.
Yeah, no.
If I was getting horny about anything, it was very explicitly Magritte going just full bloodthirsty.
Yeah.
I love her. I love her so much.
Love a girl boss.
You love to see a girl boss winning. And what is a queen if not the apex girl boss?
That is very true. No two girl bosses in a hive.
Like, maybe empress, but like, in a lot of places, the queen is like the highest you can get on the girl boss ladder.
It's true. Can't get girl bossier than that. Was there anything else we wanted to talk about with this book, or did we want to move on to the ranking?
I have a few things I wanted to mention. I really like the bit with the... We have, like, the Royal Falcono Hodgesarg.
Yeah, I love Hodgesarg!
The bit is that Lanker's native birds are not very amenable to being trained, and so, like, he's always getting his fingers bit or his throat, you know, scratched or whatever, which leads to this... And it's all set up for this really good bit where... You know, the elves are in the castle and they're doing this like whole thing where like the elves are gonna turn his birds against them, and one of them, like the elf, like has the bird on its arm and he takes the hood off and says kill, and then the bird just gouges the elf's throat out. They're like, oh yeah, they do that to me too. They're very intelligent birds.
It's a great bit. They do that a few times where it's just like the elves were not prepared for this place being just really stupid and weird.
Yeah.
Which is always just that's a great comedy bit.
Yeah.
Invader shows up and it turns out that this place is even worse than imagined. Like, that's great.
Yeah.
Big scary enemy has to play the straight man. Yeah.
And there was that. The other like joke that made me put the book down was she's getting on the broomstick with Casanunda, and Casanunda's like, dwarves aren't good with heights. You know, it's a short joke. And, you know, she's like, well, I mean, you should be able to get used to the broomstick pretty easily. It's one of those, you know, sexual metaphors. And then the footnote says, of course, this is a fallacy.
God!
Yep.
Oh, so good!
I love the way that we've already talked about this a bit, but I really love the way it describes a lot of the elf stuff. Mm-hmm. Like when Granny first sees the unicorn, specifically, it's described as the stink of it hit her. It's like, oh, that's good. That's like creepy shit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like this book a lot.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think of other stuff in it. I mostly just enjoyed it. I finished it today after being sick all week, so it's very fresh in my mind.
I mean, we get the hat stays on during sex. Iron loving iron, or ILI.
There's a lot of I'm looking back, and there were actually quite a few dick jokes in this.
Yeah,
book.
No, there's
a lot of dick jokes.
Yeah,
Was it, Weaver the Thatcher squinted at his copy of the script. "Who's this bugger Exeunt Omnis?" he said. "I don't think much of my part," said the carpenter. "It's too small." "It's his poor wife I feel sorry for," said Weaver automatically.
Yeah.
But, and then, "Why?" said Jason. Footnote, the thing about iron is that you generally don't have to think fast in dealing with it.
Yeah.
Which is a lie, but you know.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah.
There was a lot of weird, horny jokes in this book. I mean, it fits the Shakespeare book, so.
Yeah.
Can I please? I found my favorite joke of the book. I'm sorry. Can I share one more thing? It's when they first meet Cassanunda, when the wizards first run into him. The dwarf bowed and produced a slip of pasteboard from one grubby but lace-clad sleeve. "My card," he said. It read, and might I remind you, in the text here, in my printed book text anyways, this is like a bit of graphic design. Like, they have a little rectangle in different fonts. "Giamo Cassanunda, world's second greatest lover. We never sleep. Finest swordsman, outrageous liar, soldier of fortune, stepladders repaired." Ponder peered over Ridcully's shoulder. "Are you really an outrageous liar?" "No."
That was so good. I wrote that down too.
Just one of those stupid little blink and you'll miss it jokes, but I love that kind of shit.
I had one of those too when Ridcully arrives in town and he's just like, "See that tavern? Ha! If I had a penny for every time they threw me out of there, I'd have $5.38.
Yeah.
But that's still a lot.
Yeah, that's still like, a fucking lot of time.
That's a lot, but two, the specificity of it?
Yeah.
So good.
Okay, there's one that I have to pull because I just accidentally realized that joke was being made. There's really early on when Death is getting his shoe horseshoed.
Boop. Uh-huh.
And Jason is making very unwise questions, and Death describes his career as, "I like to think I'm a picker-up of unconsidered trifles."
Yeah.
Then, all the way at the tail end of the book, there's a gag about how, you know, Nanny Ogg just always helps herself whenever there's free food, and she just takes as much as she can stuff inside of her dress. And she pulls up her hat, and there she's got some sponge cake, some clotted cream, some custard, and some jelly. And then there's a footnote that she's a picker up of unconsidered trifle.
Yeah.
God damn it! That's good. I think I could definitely say I found this book to be the funniest Discworld book so far. There was a lot of really great bits.
Humor is an extremely good escape valve for horror.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I also mean, it had Nanny Ogg, who is the funniest character.
Also true, but like there was more horror in this that was done much better than it was in, say, Moving Pictures or any other attempt to use the dungeon dimensions. Because you know this was actual horror with intent instead of just being. Look, ignoring the obvious jokes, I can only be terrified of tentacles for so long.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
No, yeah.
But these just horrible knife-edged people that just want to do the worst possible things to you are genuinely scary. They are a more human terror than a bunch of undisclosed horrors.
Yeah. Callous, terrible cruelty, capable of so much just by virtue of not really caring what happens to you. They'd break the world if it made a funny sound, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, more horror, it makes it all the better to make you laugh, I guess. Mm.
To defuse that horror.
Yeah, which is, you know, again, why they do fly to a big stone dick, you know, a good chunk of the way through the book, which is based on a real thing. Look up the Cerny Abyss Giant, which is just a big chalk guy with a club and his dick out. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They just... They can't get rid of it. It's history.
It's cultural now.
They legally cannot erase that dick. It's great.
There's a...
It's not subtle.
Yeah. It really does a great job of doing a lot of good humor while also ramping up the horror as it goes on. Like I mean, just obviously the combination of it's a big dick, there's a horrifying elf god at the bottom.
Yeah.
That's just kind of what it does, and it's good stuff.
Yeah. And, like, the idea that, like, eventually they made him go away by just being like, okay, like, eventually, like, y'all are immortal. You have time. Eventually, humanity might die out, and then you can come back and you can do your little, oh, we're better than you dance and all that other bullshit. But until then, you have to stay gone. I love, like, they didn't stop being scary at the end, because essentially, like, I mean, they were stopped in the immediacy, but, like, eventually the elves will come back to collect what they feel is due. And that's such, like, a, ooh, shit.
Yeah, one day this...
That's much, it's so much more of a better concept of cosmic terror than the Dungeon Dimensions are.
One day this cultural memory, this iron in the head, as they call it, this, you know, the way the humans work the land and such, and, you know, they do their little superstitions, they hang the horseshoe over the door and such. One day, that might slip up, but it's not today.
I will say also in that bit, even though there's a part of it that's like, I don't know. At the same time, I really loved the gag of there being, like, some king buried all of his armies here to wake up at the end of the world, and Nanny just waking them up because she thinks it's funny. It's like, ha-ha! Nah, it's not the end of the world yet. I just woke you up for fun. Go to bed. As she goes along. That was great.
Yeah.
I loved getting to see her do actual witching stuff, be really impressive and spooky. It's great. I haven't gotten to see much of that from Nanny.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff.
Yeah, she's just as competent as Granny is, just in different avenues. And like she says at one point, like, you are always so good at running from the boys. You always could outrun them. Me, I tripped over every branch that I possibly could, which not only is a very horny joke, but also kind of goes to show like her kind of differing philosophy towards, like, interacting with people, I guess, and that her magic is a lot more grounded in interpersonal magic. She like, essentially did this huge-ass power move of, like, being able to go into the Longman, and, like, really it was only to just, like, negotiate, essentially. That's really neat. It's a different flavor yet from Magrin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's another moment near the end where Nanny is like, there's this thing that says, like, Nanny had gotten very far knowing when to not be a witch in life. And it's this great thing of, like, that's what she's good at. It's not that she hasn't been doing things, it's that, like, she's very good at purposefully avoiding it.
Yeah.
And she can pull this out when she wants.
Gritty talks a lot about knowing when not to be a witch. But Nanny is better at actually not being a witch. Yeah, like, she can.
Granny's kind of dumb.
Granny's a little too proud to necessarily practice what she preaches a lot of the time. I don't think she's dumb. She's very, very smart. But I think that, like I said, she's sharpened her confidence to a knife's edge, and now she relies on it.
Yeah, she cannot afford to, like, second guess herself, for better or for worse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Good.
There's
dynamics.
The whole thing near the beginning where she borrows something to takes over an animal in order to figure out what's going on, while Nanny just goes into town and asks someone and threatens them with, like, yelling at them a bunch, and they immediately tell her exactly what happened.
Yeah, very, like, she knows, like, I'll just go tell your mom or whatever. Like, the sort of, the power of, like, I delivered you. Like, I fucking know everyone in town. It's a small town. Like,
I saw you crowd. Yeah. Don't talk to me like that.
And then there's also a lot of bee metaphors in this book, and it sort of comes together at the end, but mostly it feels like it's just so Granny could do a really cool thing.
Yeah, like,
you might call it a bee plot.
No.
Ah.
But,
oh man.
Yeah, it's weird because there's a bunch of metaphors in this book, and that's the only one that I was like, I don't know. I don't really get that one. Doesn't feel like it quite works.
Yeah, but we got can't have two queens in a hive. That was so cool. About, you know,
there can't be two queens in one hive, and, you know, the younger queen's got vigor on her side, but, and everything to gain, but the old queen has everything to lose.
Yeah, but, like, I don't know. It just didn't quite fully work for me in the way that I think it was supposed to. Although
it didn't really add anything to that fight, because there already were plenty of stakes.
Like,
although the beekeeper killing the elves because he recognized them as wasps.
Yeah.
And also, it leading to Granny becoming bees for a while. Both of those were great moments.
Yeah. I loved the beekeeper. I thought it was interesting that the book names him as like the it's Maggard who sees him as like the closest male counterpart to a witch because like he has mystic bee knowledge. Which we're already at an hour, so I don't want to get into more gender politic. But there's something going on there.
Yeah.
You know? The book doesn't get into it that much, but there's something going on there. I'm excited to see see more gender conversations in these books.
Oh boy.
So that I have more to talk about.
Give me the bee boy and free my soul.
God damn it.
Anyways, let's talk.
Wait,
rankings.
We didn't what was everyone's favorite joke? We already went over most of them, but it's I want to make sure there weren't any I missed. Yeah. There were a lot of good jokes in this book. Anyone have one we haven't covered yet?
I think we're
pretty
good.
Yeah, I went down my favorites. Other than maybe the story about the cow suppository pills. That was pretty good, too, but I don't know if it was my favorite, you know?
It was at least a funny story, but it wasn't really like... It wasn't one that made you put the book down and go take a walk.
Yeah.
This is fair. Mm. I have to do this bit because I always forget all the jokes and then get reminded of them. This time we didn't forget them because they were too good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were good. They stayed in your mind. So I think with some pretty good confidence, we can say that this is better than Witches Abroad, I want to say. Okay. Do we think that it's better than Mort?
I think so.
This is much more well-formed than Mort.
Okay. What about Guards, Guards?
Yeah.
Okay.
I like Guards, Guards a lot, but this is better.
What about Reaper Man?
Now's where it gets hard.
Ooh.
See, part of the problem here is that, like, I like the elves a lot more than I like, you know, there's some gender here that's going to bias me towards this book. I'm trying to balance that out. Like, I find the elves a lot more, like, compelling as a villain than the Flesh Maul.
The highs of this book were not as high as Reaper Man, but the lows were also not as low as Reaper Man.
Yeah.
Yeah, this book was more consistent than Reaper Man was the thing.
Yeah. What's after Reaper Man?
Small Gods.
After Reaper Man is our number one on the list, Small Gods. Reaper Man is number two, Small Gods is number one.
I don't think this is better than Small Gods.
No. But I think it could. I could see it being better than Reaper Man. But it would be really close.
I feel like
we could have this conversation tomorrow and we might come up with a different answer.
Yeah. Maybe we could put it at number three, because Reaper Man's like Miss Renata in Reaper Man was so, and like the bit with Bill Dorr and like, and the fire and so good. and I really did love Wendell Poons a whole lot in Reaper Man.
I love this book, but I have to like Reaper Man more, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think
I'm voting for three.
But I think third place is still extremely respectable, and this book comes heavily recommended.
Yeah, like, what was fourth again?
Fourth was Guards, Guards, if we're putting this in
three. Honestly, I have to say, I think this book is, like, a league better than Guards, Guards. And that's one of my favorite books.
Yes.
There's still definitely a demarcation there. But
The tier list might be coming up soon. And like, I really like this book, but, you know, Reaper Man did make me cry. So, like...
Yeah. So, coming in at number three, extremely respectable, that's going to be Lords and Ladies. Stay tuned for our next episode when we cover Men-at-Arms, the second Watch book, and a return of our favorite salty old asshole, Commander Vimes.
I'm really curious about this one, because I know...
Which is going to be
fun. I know the third Watch book is when I'm really like, yeah, this is the Vimes I know, so I'm curious what I think of the second one. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, I'm just sitting here looking at the first part of the summary, and one link stands out, and I go, okay, I remember which one this is.
Yeah, I posted a photo of it, of the copy I got in the room a little while back in our little Discord channel, and like I got one of the Josh Kirby covers, and it is fucking wild how he decided to render all of the police gang.
I'm sorry, I just don't like his art. It's just not very good.
I'm sorry, Detra just literally looks like a pile of crap.
Everything is melting all the time.
So, before we wrap up, we did get some fan mail. Here to talk. First off, from a listener, Heather Robertson.
Hi, Heather.
Yeah. We actually have some pictures of Rincewind and Two Flower kissing. Woo! Check it out. Holy I'm shit. Linking the Tumblr right now.
Oh, yeah.
Post tag the Discworld. Oh, yeah, baby. This
oh,
is
yeah.
Good shit.
Someone drew them kissing. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Kind of drew Rincewind like Guybrush Threepwood, but you know what? I'm here for it. And definitely took some cues from the Sean Astin interpretation from the movies for Two Flower. Yeah. But that is fine.
No, I can dig this.
I'm not so much glad about this as much as I'm glad that someone has done it. Thank you.
Yeah.
The world deserved this.
Yeah.
Those books didn't deserve it, but the world deserves it.
Yeah. Happy ending.
Mm-hmm. Also, we got a message from Jace. Pronounced they, it, she, saying, "Hey, y'all talking about small gods and other stuff place too many thoughts in my head, so I'm going to make it everyone's Woo! Problem. First, if you do a tech theme spinoff episode, it should be called DOS Covers."
Oh.
I agree. That's a great idea. We'll save that for the Mud episode. Second, I can't wait till we get to meet the Omnium Priest from Carpe Jugulum, because while I do think Sir Terry can be a bit of an annoying atheist at times, seeing a priest who's just kind of a guy with his own issues is pretty great. I am firmly in the belief that Catholic Church bad, but the book itself's got some pretty okay points in it, and JC would probably be a pretty chill guy to hang out with. His first miracle is making wine that you'd probably like to party. Third, being called a TikTok teen is really funny, as I am fully 23. With love, Jace.
Ah, you sweet summer child.
P.S. Related to fan art of Rincewind and Two Flower and or Monstrous Regiment, if you draw it, they will come. Like the saying, if you build it, they will come, but come is spelled
scum. Thank
I
you.
Am sorry. Don't ever be sorry for cum jokes. I love the cum comedy.
Comedy, if
Hell
you
yes. Thank you, Jace.
I.
It's going to be really interesting to see the Omnians pop up again in future books, because, like, Small Gods is part of the canon.
Yeah. That character, Oates, has my favorite cameo in any Discworld book. I have not actually read Carpe Jugulum. It is like the big one that I haven't read that I really need to, even though I know a ton of stuff from it. I'm very excited for it. But he shows up later in a different book, and it's great. Can't say how.
Yeah.
No spoilers.
Also, I'm just keeping my mouth shut.
Oh boy, I don't know what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, excitement. We also got people excited about the new episode on Twitter. One person said that I defaulted to he, him pronouns for the author of Dress Up Darling, but I think the author is female. If that's the case, I apologize.
I don't know.
I wasn't aware.
Huh.
I don't actually know. And on queer.party, our Mastodon account for any of you decentralized folks, Ricario says, "Hey, Disc Pod, good fucking podcast." Thanks, Ricario. We appreciate it.
That's like actual fan mail. That's just like being a fan over messaging.
It's just being a fan, just saying, I like this.
I'm not used to fan mail being fan mail.
That's kind.
So I did.
Lovely. But yeah, if you'd like to
look it up, the author of Dress Up Darling is Shinichi Fukuda, who is a woman. Hell yeah, I didn't know that.
Fuck yeah.
Oh, well, that explains why the female characters in it actually like feel like real people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And not just etchy bait.
Yeah.
Anyways, if you'd like to write us fan mail, you can do so at our email address at disc@hypnovire.us. That's DISC@hypnovire.us. We also have a Twitter @DiscPod, and we have a Mastodon account @DiscPod at queer.party. So feel free to message us. If we like your comment, we'll read it on air. Feel free to let us know about things you agreed with or things you don't agree with. And we'll tell you why you have a huge brain and or are wrong. Probably at least one, maybe both. But yeah, thanks for listening to Disc Covers. We really appreciate it. My name's Iris J. You can find me at Iris J Comics on Twitter or Mastodon.social. Trying to think of what I wanted to recommend this week. I'm going to recommend, you know what? I've been listening to a lot of Marina, formerly of Marina and the Diamonds. I've been listening to a lot of her new album, Ancient Dreams in a Modern Land. That's a good album. She, her last album, I wasn't amazingly into. This one, she's back on top of her game, baby. Great stuff. Thanks, hell Marina. Yeah. You rock, girl.
I'm June. Find me online at Juniper Theory on Twitter. I have to rescind an earlier recommendation because I recommended Ranking of Kings, which was great. It was really good, and then it went weird pro Japanese nationalist in a
What the fuck was that? I'm so really sorry. Weird. Oh my
just,
god!
Just one of those baffling. Oh wow. Okay. Well. All right. But. So while I could recommend my current favorite anime, Birdie Wing, which is a deranged show about girls playing golf, I'm going to wait until it's over.
Birdie Wing.
I'm going to wait. Yes. Instead, I'll recommend, I just watched all of Revolutionary Girl Utena, which I've seen most of before, but hadn't watched start to finish.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really good. It's good. It's still good. It's from the 80s, and it's still good. Watch it.
Love that, Utena.
I am still Belina, and I'm going to cut this one short because it's easier to find me in the show notes, and I don't have anything great to plug right now because I've been sick, too, the last week.
Aww.
Plugging, not getting sick.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I recommend getting lots of sleep and fluids.
What can I say?
I'll put the Wikipedia page for fluid on here.
Discoverers is coming out as pro-fluid. I have been...
Fluids, we're into it.
I have been the Internet's beloved Princess Grace. You can find my writing, programs, podcast posts, everything else that fits to plug at princess.software. For things to recommend, I don't know, most been playing Peglin. It's in early access. It's a roguelike deck builder, but instead of being like every other game like that, it's Peggle. You build a deck of orbs that you shoot at pegs. It's good.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, remember how Peggle had one good game then immediately vanished because EA has never made a good business decision in its life? Mm-hmm.
Someone else made a good Peggle game.
Yeah, you get to play a little goblin with a bag full of orbs and a heart full of wishes. And it's in early access, but I'm rooting for it.
Man, I love a good orb.
Hell yes.
Yeah.
That's great. Best of luck to that cute little goblin.
I know we're disc coverers, but we can also be orb heads.
That's true. If you want to take a break from being a discette, become a
Orberoni?
Orberoni. Yes, there we go.
I'm baffled by this conversation.
I was trying to make some kind of Orboboros joke, but it just wasn't coming together.
Thanks for listening, folks. Truly, truly, they were lords and also ladies.
Follow your dreams, folks.
So long.
Good night.
Wait, hold on a second. They're called the lords and ladies, but the elves all had its pronouns, except for the queen and king.
Well, that's just gender right there, baby.
I think sometimes Terry would slip up and call it one of the elves he.
Maybe, but we know.
Yeah, yeah.
Gender.
Yeah, I played Fallen London, I'm used to it.
God.